Bonjour à tous. Aujourd'hui, nous recevons Monsieur Baxter, qui vient nous rencontrer. Je vous remercie, Monsieur Baxter, d'être ici. C'est un grand plaisir de vous rencontrer après avoir lu beaucoup de vos livres. Hélas, pour l'instant, tous n'ont pas encore été publiés en français, même certains des plus anciens. Mais, enfin, en tout cas, pas aussi vite que les lecteurs l'auraient souhaité. Mais nous avons pu apprécier, entre autres, des écrits comme Voyage, comme Titan, des séries comme Les Enfants de la Destinée, ainsi que le cycle des univers multiples, Manifold. La plupart du temps, des ouvrages plutôt de hard science, conçus sur des bases scientifiques aussi solides que possible. Alors, je vais vous poser d'abord une première question. C'est vous êtes un écrivain, mais vous êtes aussi un scientifique. Alors, est-ce que c'est le scientifique qui a eu envie d'écrire de la science-fiction, ou est-ce que c'est parce que vous aimiez la science-fiction que vous êtes devenu un scientifique?
Well, first of all, thank you. It's a pleasure to be here, and thank you to the festival for inviting me and for the administrators for all the hard work and all of that. Thank you very much. Yes, good question. I was a keen science fiction fan from a very young age, from watching H.G. Wells films on the TV and the kids' puppet shows and so on, and I graduated into the books when I was 12 or so. And it was really science fiction that attracted me to science. So at school I started taking science subjects, and I was good at maths, and that was a mathematics. That was a way forward for me. I mean, what I really wanted to do was be an astronaut, or possibly an engineer, a rocket engineer. But I'm not practical, and I'm not particularly physically sporty or in any way. I would never have been tough enough to be an astronaut. So, but science was the next best, and I did have a dream of going into astrophysics, maybe, or engineering again. And but it was the science fiction that was really my motivation. I did a maths degree in the end at university, a first degree in mathematics, and then engineering research for a doctorate. And that was in civil engineering. It was aircraft acoustics, reducing the noise from civil aircraft. So it was an interesting topic, and I enjoyed it. And I particularly enjoyed, I was working on a novel problem to do with a wind tunnel, an experimental noise controlling wind tunnel. And they couldn't map the sound field in there. It was a complex three-dimensional sound field. But the mathematical technique I managed to find that worked in the end for to analyze this sound field was based on the Voyager probe, which went past Jupiter and Saturn. And the Voyagers took one pass through the magnetic fields of those planets. And from the one pass, from the one sample, through this complex three-dimensional field, they figured out ways to mathematically model the whole field. So I just stole all that mathematics and applied it to the wind tunnel, which was, you know, it's an interesting thing that something that works on the scale of Jupiter will also work on the scale of a 10-meter wind tunnel. However, I was always restless. I started writing when I was at school, writing properly, submitting stories to magazines, didn't sell for a long time. But science fiction was my real goal. So after that, I moved around, I worked in industry, and I was a teacher for a while. But my writing career slowly built up. I sold short stories to magazines in Britain and America, and finally sold a novel when I was in my late 20s. And after that, my writing career slowly took off as my engineering career slowly declined. And so I ended up where I'd started from. But yeah, it was science fiction that motivated me to go into science, I think. And I think since then I've met plenty of scientists who were attracted to hard SF, including NASA engineers, for instance, NASA in America, who, you know, they're big science fiction fans, and there's clearly an interplay between science and science fiction. The dreams motivate the reality of the next generation of engineers, and those engineers' accomplishments in turn inspire the next generation of science fiction writers. So there's a big interplay between the two communities, I think.
Bien, merci. Et effectivement, donc vous avez un petit peu parlé de l'espace dans. Vous parlez un petit peu de l'espace dans votre réponse. Mais on sent au travers de toute votre œuvre justement que l'espace est quelque chose qui vous passionne, même si vous n'avez pas eu la chance d'y aller. Et, Donc, on sent que pour vous, la conquête de l'espace, quand même, par l'humanité, c'est quelque chose de fort, quelque chose d'important. Pour vous, c'est quelque chose qui est inéluctable ou pas?
Yes, space was always a big motivator for me. I was 11 when Apollo 11 landed on the moon. I was just the right age for that. I was old enough to understand roughly what was going on with Gemini and the early Apollo flights. And then, so there was 11, an early teenager, when this fantastic adventure was unfolding. And, well, as you'll remember, the promise then was that this would just be the beginning, not the end. You know, there would be bases on the moon, extended flights, there would be missions to Mars and all those things, none of which happened, of course. I think psychologically, for people of my generation, it was quite difficult to grow up and then suddenly the boyhood dream is snatched away as if it was all an illusion. Now, I mean, you know, yesterday the Ares rocket was launched as the first trial of the prototype of Ares, the next generation of American space technology, hopefully a first step back to the moon and to Mars. It seems so much more difficult now than it did then. You know, the Americans took such a huge step backwards. However, you know, we can't ignore what has been achieved in space since then. The Americans and the Russians before them, of course, have learned to endure long periods in space. I met the cosmonaut whose name escapes me now, this is terrible, but the guy who holds the record for the most number of days in space, something like 500 days on the Mir and then in the International Space Station. So patiently, they've have been laying down a groundwork of learning how to work and survive in space, even though they haven't actually been anywhere. I'm convinced it's important to keep humans going into space. We need the science return from the space program to survive on Earth, I would say. You know, there are strong arguments for this. If only we could mine the moon and mine the asteroids rather than mine the Earth. If we could generate power in space rather than on the Earth. Earth could become a kind of garden, a park, with all the nasty industries outside. I mean, this seems to be a way forward over the next century or so. And then the science as well. We've learned so much just in my lifetime about Mars and Venus and the planets beyond the solar system now, all of which are lessons to be applied back to the Earth. If we only had the Earth, it would be like medicine, with only one body to study. You know, you need an understanding of planetology to be able to understand and manage this planet. So I'm convinced that we need a space program on some level. But do we need humans to go there? Well, I strongly believe we do. I really admire the rovers on Mars, for instance. There's little brave, plucky rovers that have, what, 3 or 4 years now? They've kept on working and they've covered kilometers. But the science they've done could have been done by one human geologist in a couple of days. Well, they're in different places, two in a couple of days. So there must come a point where, you know, the cost versus the benefit argues in favor of sending humans up there, just in terms of the science. And then the sheer wonder, when I researched my novels based on near future space, so Voyage, about going to Mars, and Moonseed, which is a disaster story, but there's a strong reason to go back to the moon. I looked at the Apollo records. There are things called the Lunar Surface Journals, which are available online, which are kind of debriefs of the astronauts just after they got back from the moon. And they were mostly pilots, weren't they? There's one geologist was sent up there. And they were trained to be very observational, but very unpoetic. They had no motivation to admit they were ever frightened or disoriented because they needed to get the next flight. But they were trying to at least brief following missions about the real experience of being on the moon. And some of it is extraordinary, the human detail of, you know, that when they try to sleep, there's two of them in the lunar module, the only two people on the planet in this fragile little vessel with paper-thin walls. When they slept, it was a difficult time for them, I think, because the work and mission control and all that, the checklists weren't there to distract them. And their imagination seemed to expand, and they seemed to understand where they were. Or the command module pilots alone circling the moon, the only guy in orbit. When he was on the far side of the moon, he was here, and the universe is there. The whole of the rest of mankind is over here. Extraordinary experiences. Some of the visual effects as well, because you've got a close horizon, and no atmosphere, so there's no mist. So all you are the distance perceptions that have been programmed into us since as we've evolved go out the window on the moon as they would on Mars. So they had fantasies of objects moving closer and further away. They constantly misjudged distances, both too near and too far, and so on. And it was a dreamlike experience, I think, in which things swim towards and away from you. Colors aren't right, shadows aren't right, and so on. And you can see this in these kind of terse pilot's reports, you know, reading between the lines. It's quite extraordinary. And I think we need astronauts exploring to get to the human dimension of this experience.
Vous-même, vous avez, je crois, postulé pour aller dans l'espace, même si bon, vous n'avez pas eu la chance de le faire. Est-ce que cela aussi a guidé un petit peu vos choix en termes d'écriture, en termes d'histoire, raconter l'histoire, cette aventure vers Mir?
Yes, in a way. I did apply to be an astronaut in around about 1989. The Russians were hosting guest astronauts or cosmonauts on the Mir space station at the time, and there was going to be one space available for somebody from Britain. And I thought, well, and I was, how old would I be then? About 32 or 33. I was about the right age. I had the right qualifications. You had to have a science higher degree because there was science to be done. I was fit enough. On the Soyuz, you don't have to be super fit. The acceleration's 2 or 3 G. It's like a roller coaster. If you can survive a roller coaster, you can survive the accelerations. And so I rang up. There was a telephone number, and I called this telephone number. And there was an advert in the paper, I remember, which said, astronaut wanted, no experience required. And so I just rang, and I went through these hurdles. Yes, I was the right age. I had a British passport. Everything was right. But I was let down. No British person could speak a foreign language, can they? You had to speak one foreign language. French would have done. Many Russians speak French. But I didn't speak French fluently, and that let me down. I should have lied. I should have lied and crash-studied French for a month and tried to get in that way. I think if I'd been selected, I would have gone. I would have tried to go and see how far I could have gone. In the end, they chose a woman who worked in an industrial factory, so who was a bit more of a kind of Soviet hero figure, I think, maybe more suitable than some of the pilots and so forth who got to the later stages. I don't think I would have made the final cut, but it would have been really interesting to go through the training and see how far I could get. I think in the end, to be honest, I don't think I would have had the physical courage. I mean, I could have survived the experiences on a purely biological level, I think. But the confinement and the dependence on machinery and the claustrophobia and all those things, I think I would have had trouble with. I've tried things like scuba diving since then, and scuba diving, that sense of dependency on a machine is quite, I find it quite claustrophobic, deeply terrifying in many ways. So that's led me to really admire people who actually do it. The Soyuz is a very safe machine. No accidents for nearly 40 years now, I think. However, I've climbed inside a dummy. It's incredibly small, cramped space, and you know you're so close that your knees are touching the knees of the guy next to you in your suits. And to think of going through a launch into space in such a thing is terrifying. I think you do need a high degree of physical courage to make it.
Et donc la question, c'est est-ce que cela vous a nourri votre écriture? Est-ce que vous en êtes servi de cette expérience pour effectivement, on trouve des choses qui pourraient, dans Voyage, par exemple, venir de ce type d'expérience?
Well, yes, I did. And I've always tried to get as much physical experience of what I'm writing about as possible. Voyage was about going to Mars. I can't go to Mars, but I could go to NASA and see the sites. And they let me climb around inside a space shuttle simulator, for instance. And I saw the Moon Rock Laboratory and the huge vacuum chamber they have, where they're now testing parts of the new Orion spacecraft project there. Seeing NASA as a functioning organization on the ground was very interesting. It was all, it's 1960s, you know, all the architecture is 1960s. It's all these cubes and ceiling tiles and narrow corridors and linoleum on the floor. It must have looked very stylish in 1962, but now it's like an old hospital or a government building in Poland. You know, no disrespect to Poland, it seems very old-fashioned. And NASA is now a 50-year-old bureaucracy. You know, so and as with all bureaucracies, like all large organizations, you have warring camps, the astronauts versus the trainers versus the engineers and so on. So all this fueled my understanding of how it would be to work there, you know, and to fight your way through. And I think the experiences of being able to get of climbing into these mock-ups of the spacecraft are as close as I'm going to get to the real thing. But I do try to... If my characters are going to do something physical and real, I'll try to do it just to imagine what they're going through. For instance, in Voyage, you have the first human on Mars, the first woman on Mars, and she's doing the Neil Armstrong thing of climbing down the ladder. So as I worked this out, I got a ladder from the garden, set it up in my study, and climbed down, worked out where is a hand, you know, where is a foot at this moment, which foot is she going to put on the ground first, just to get more physically in the moment. You know, I think there's a lot to be said for trying to immerse yourself as far as possible in this kind of way. But Voyage was adapted into a radio performance, not a reading, but an actual a dramatization, is the word I'm looking for. And I went to see some of it being recorded, I'm sorry. And surprisingly, they did a lot of dressing up and play acting in physically. You'd think they'd stand around a microphone and just act. No, not in this case. If they were in a capsule together, the director would put them physically together in a small room. If they had to wear communications helmets, he'd put something on their heads, balaclavas, you know, just something to make it feel as if they were in an unusual physical situation. Because the director's theory was it affects the way you speak. If you're cramped up, you know, it affects the way you act, which in turn affects the way you sound and so on. So I think the more physical experience you can get of all these things, the better.
Alors, là, nous avons parlé surtout de technologie et de l'homme, mais au-delà de la technologie, j'ai l'impression que vos ouvrages, lorsqu'ils parlent non seulement de l'homme et de l'espace, mais aussi de possibilités, d'éventualités, je trouve au travers de vos écrits, tant pour le futur que pour des passés éventuellement alternatifs. Il y a presque, je dirais, une espèce d'approche un peu mystique de l'espace et de la place de l'homme dans l'espace. Comment vous arrivez à concilier, à gérer cette approche avec la hard science que vous écrivez?
Well, that's another interesting question. I think the appeal of SF for me has always been context and perspective. And the best metaphor I have was something said by Philip K. Dick once. He said he imagined the world as a square on a chessboard or a checkerboard. You know what I mean, a draughts board? So we're in this one square, but there's a whole set of squares ahead of us in the row. That's the future. Squares in the past, behind us, that's the past. Worlds we can't understand, probably. Perhaps even a couple of generations ago, the world would seem very alien if you were dropped down into it now. But also the rows to either side are alternative possibilities. And to him, science fiction was a way of exploring these other possibilities, at least in a fictional way, which in turn give perspective back onto the small square that we inhabit. So it's all a question of perspective and context. And when it comes to man's future in space or not, well, whether we like it or not, we're embedded in space. Whether we leave the Earth or not, we're embedded in the larger universe. And the huge questions of existence seem to be only to get deeper. I mean, our understanding of the universe in my lifetime has dramatically expanded. I went to a conference at Imperial College in London this year, which is where H.G. Wells studied a long time ago. And they had a bunch of physicists and astronomers giving science fiction writers lectures. I think partly because the physicists and astronomers are impatient about how much we get wrong, you know, or how much we don't know. But the extraordinary understanding we have now of the story of the universe, at least from the beginning up to the present, from the Big Bang to the present, the future and the very far future seems more unconstrained to me. It seems to me they understand it less. All this, you know, 95% of the universe is still unknown. How can we say what's going to happen in the future? But the mystery of existence, as illuminated by all these answers, only seems to me to get deeper. Why, suppose we're alone, do we really need this vast architecture of this immense and ancient universe just for us here and now? If we're not alone, how is it that we don't see them? This is the Fermi paradox. You know, Fermi, this Italian physicist who, in the 1950s, he said, if the aliens exist, if UFOs exist, why don't we see them? Why isn't it obvious? We should see their works all around us. They should be landing the whole time. We should see the modified stars in the sky and so on. But we don't. Where are they? Which is a very deep question, which has come to fascinate me. So, I mean, it seems to me that the only way we're going to get answers to this kind of question is again through the space program. Its space-borne instruments have given us the best information we have on the large-scale structure of the universe and on, you know, the planets of other stars, this extraordinary geography of the galaxy that we're starting to understand. And it's only through the space program, through getting to Mars, digging in the dirt and seeing if anything is alive there, that we're going to begin to understand if we're alone or not, if this thing is related to us or not. Are we the highest life forms in the universe so far? What can that put, you know, all these deep questions. It seems to me it's our very existence is a complete baffling mystery in terms of the very deepest questions. Why are we here? Where are we going? And where is everybody else? And so the hard science and the technology are the small steps on the ladder to get us there. I don't think, your question was asking about paradoxes and contradictions, I think. It seems to me that there's no real contradiction. You have to have the hard science of the first steps on the ladder, of what you can actually measure and achieve and be sure of here and now. But that in turn leads in the future to the bigger issues. The great thing about being a science fiction writer is I can use those first rungs and go leaping, you know, like Jacob up the ladder, off to infinity.
Oui, alors justement, dans vos ouvrages, certains parlent d'un futur très lointain, parfois. Et pour finir, en fait, souvent, j'ai l'impression que vos livres se terminent par des avenirs qui sont un peu vides. Il y a une espèce d'un zeste d'amertume, je trouve, dans vos finales, dans votre avenir tout au bout du temps. Et on le retrouve, par exemple, dans Temps, ou on le retrouve aussi dans l'anthologie des Utopias, Georges et la comète, la petite, très bonne anthologie d'ailleurs. Et donc, pourquoi est-ce que vous allez aussi loin finalement? Parce que, effectivement, comme vous dites, vous montez les marches. Pourquoi aller aussi loin, à un endroit où effectivement l'homme n'aura jamais le regard et puis se faire mal en disant là-bas ce sera tellement alien, tellement différent que on n'aura plus notre place.
Well, just why do I go that far? Just because it's so fascinating. This is the context, you know. One thing we know about the universe, I think, is that it's not going to stay the same, and so we can't stay the same. Maybe we'll go extinct is one possibility. Maybe we will survive, but in some, or our remote descendants will survive, but in some fantastically evolved form. I mean, this is H.G. Wells' The Time Machine showed us this, or showed the late Victorians this truth very graphically. This thing seems to me a fascinating idea, a fantastic idea, that the far future will be so different, just as the past was so different. So how could you not explore it? I do seem to be drawn to futures in which mankind disappears altogether, as you suggest, or is so far evolved that we're no longer recognizable. But again, what a perspective that shows back on this time we live in now. Maybe the reason we're alone is just because we're unique. Maybe civilizations and minds like ours have only evolved once, or maybe it's always short term. You know, maybe there's always something, resource depletion or something that stops the story before long. In which case, take yourself forward to the ruins and look back on this great heaping now, and what does it mean for us? H.G. Wells, again, in The Time Machine, you recall that the time traveler goes forward, he sees the ruined world of the future and the desolate beach at the end of time, then he comes back and describes all this to his companions. And the writer, right at the end of the book, he says, what does it mean for us if all our civilization is just a foolish heaping of brick upon brick, and it's all going to be rubbed away by time? He says, it's up to us to behave as if it were not so, which is a sort of an expression of faith, in a way, of what to do, you know, in a godless universe in which everything will be erased. I think it's difficult to think about the future without considering these possibilities. You know, if I sometimes think that all science fiction, in a way, is about mortality. We're finite creatures in space, but we're also finite in time. And you know, maybe we're going to have some kind of breakthrough in terms of longevity technology in the future. But in the meantime, we're all going to be gone soon enough. In a century or so, nobody here probably will be alive. Sorry to be gloomy, but we won't be. However, the genes will go on, our children will go on. But in the end, you know, lines die out. Perhaps the species will die out. In the end, nothing you do or leave behind, not even your genes, may survive to the very furthest future. And so what is the meaning of life in that context? Once again, these seem to be extraordinarily deep questions, which science fiction is uniquely equipped to answer. George in the comments, I should say, is a funny story, I like to think, in which there's a humorous take that far future aliens have tried to save at least something of humanity. They kind of got it wrong. They put humans in monkey bodies, which isn't too bad given the context, and it's probably not much worse than the reconstructions we make of some of our ancestors from the past. But even so, that these characters at the far end of time have to confront this truth that man came and went, and there we were. You know, there's one very gloomy scientific analysis of this question, which is this: if you were to choose a human, if you imagine all the humans who ever existed lined up in order of their birth, let's say from the emergence from the chimps all the way up to extinction, and you pick one at random, would you expect to pick one from the middle of the bunch, or from the very very beginning, or the very very end? And you know, doing it blind, you would think it's going to be someone from the middle of the bunch. In which case, we randomly observe now might expect to be somewhere in the middle of the pack. It's if humanity goes on to a far future of colonizing the galaxy, and there are trillions upon trillions upon trillions of us, then we're among the very first few humans who've ever lived, which seems unlikely. You know, so that kind of statistical argument suggests that there may be only as many humans after us who have come before. Which is a scary thought. It depends how you do the maths, you know. There have been something like 100 billion humans before us. 7 billion are alive now. So there may be not all that many centuries ahead in terms of another 100 billion. I don't know whether to believe that kind of thing or not, but it's an interesting argument. You know, there's no reason to be complacent. And to assume that we're going to have a vast galactic mankind in the future is maybe a complacent analysis. I don't, you know, I've got no fixed views about the future. Who knows? I've written many contradictory versions of the future and the human future. But certainly the futures in which we decline or vanish seem just as compelling to me as the ones in which we advance and advance to greater things.
Alors, je vais me permettre un parallèle un petit peu osé, mais lorsqu'on regarde votre œuvre, vous avez beaucoup travaillé sur des cycles. Vos romans forment souvent des cycles. Qui vivent et puis qui disparaissent eux aussi, un peu comme ces civilisations dont vous parlez, et vous ne revenez pratiquement plus jamais sur ces cycles précédents, vous passez à autre chose. Donc d'une part, pensez-vous avoir besoin d'un temps particulier, d'un espace spécifique pour raconter une histoire, puis après c'est terminé? Est-ce que la porte se referme en fait sur cet univers imaginaire, ce carré que vous avez inventé?
Well, it's not quite true that I've not returned to any of these cycles, sequences. I think I write, and many SF writers write in series and sequences and so forth, just because so many of these ideas are so huge that one novel, you know, doesn't really do it justice. A novel is a big project. A novel is a year-long project, but you know, you need more than one novel to get to grips with these really big ideas, I think. But my first series was the Zeely sequence, and that started with my first first published story. And really, before that first publication, I think I was still kind of under the spell of my influences, if you know what I mean. I was learning. I'd written some stories, but they're varying quality, I suppose, and none of them fit together. But that first story, just because it was the first one published, crystallized things in a way. And it was about humans in a kind of space opera future, which is dominated by one species who are godlike, the Zili, above everybody else. And I was writing a gadget story, you know, just a puzzle story, really, quite a slight thing. But I had these offstage Zili, these godlike aliens, setting the agenda for everybody else. The next story I published was an end of time story in which mankind has been saved, again by godlike aliens. And it occurred to me to put the two together. So you have the beginning of a huge sequence and the end of a huge sequence. And so in my next few stories, my first novels, I was exploring this universe. It was all quite unconscious, and I've kind of recorded the dates and the characters and so forth as I've gone along, but it was, especially in the first few years, it was all, this is my influences, you know, my unconscious working really. I'm not like Terry Pratchett, who's done, 25 or something books in the Discworld sequence. I really admire that, but that's not for me. I do like to do different things. My second novel, actually, in the middle of all the Zili stuff, was an alternate history called Anti-Ice, set at the time of the Franco-Prussian War, actually, as it happens. So I've always been interested in different types of story and different modes of storytelling. But I have returned to the Zili sequence. I think I produced 4 novels in a collection, left it for a while, then came back with the Destiny's Children series. That's a sort of subsequence set within the broader scale. But my interest had changed by then. I think the early books were ideas driven. How to develop the ideas, the structure of the universe in a way. I think with the later books, I was more interested in how it would be to live in such a universe. In the Zili books, we do go on to become a galactic mankind, and we wage a galactic war for 1,000,000 years against the Zili. And this was a throwaway paragraph in one of the early stories. But I just became interested in that. How could we humans possibly organize ourselves to wage a galactic war on a scale of 1,000,000 years? But I thought, well, it's not impossible. I think possibly to Bronze Age man, it would have seemed impossible that we could wage a global war like the Second World War, and yet we did. I was influenced by going to see Churchill's underground bunker in London, which has been preserved, restored since wartime. This bomb shelter, you know, very small space, but he had a big map of the world with pins showing where the fleets were and pins showing where the battles were going on. It really was a global war, and they visualized it on a global scale. So I imagined humans waging a 1,000,000-year-long global war against the Zili. But how would it feel to be caught in the middle of that? And so my characters in the middle of the book of that sequence, anyway, are child soldiers. You know, all their subspecies has known, really, is this endless war. They're bred. They're not drones. They have to show initiative. You know, they're pilots and so on, navigators. But they're basically soldiers, and they're disposable, and they don't expect to live long. And their whole slogan is, a brief life burns brightly. This is what they're told from the beginning. So how is it to... What kind of culture emerges in those situations? Obviously, this reflects back to you know, the child soldiers of the present day. So I think I have come back to that one sequence at least. I think it's not a bad idea to go back to your roots as a writer. I suspect your first works in many ways are truer than what comes later, because it is your influences. You're less in control of the material. Your subconscious is more active in a way than later. This Arthur C. Clarke, as an example, his novel The City and the Stars, you know, that was one of his first longer works that he drafted at the age of 19 or something like that. Put it aside, sold it as a short story or a novella-length piece to one of the magazines in the States, put it aside again, wrote a version of it as a novel, put it aside again, came back to it later. So he spent something like 20 years going back to this kind of, root story, which for him, Olaf Stapleton was the great influence for him, so it's a very Stapletonian story. So I think the Zili series is my version of that, you know. I keep on going back and digging into my subconscious in a way. And I think in some ways some of my other series have been responses to the Zili universe. I think you could say the Zili stuff is slightly old-fashioned. I hate to say it, but the first story was published in 1987, so that's quite a long time ago. And it is a slightly old-fashioned space opera universe. It's like Larry Niven's Known Space, where it's crowded with lesser species waging war and invading each other and trading, but also with you've got the Zili as these godlike overview figures. So the Fermi paradox applies in the Zili universe. If we are in the Zili universe, why aren't we being invaded? Or why don't we see the great works of the Zili in the sky? So my Manifold books, my Manifold series, is all about the Fermi paradox. Different answers to the Fermi paradox. In there you have the same set of characters starting at the same point in time in different universes dominated by different answers to the Fermi paradox. In the first, we're alone. And so what is our responsibility if we really are the only minds in the universe? It must mean that mind is difficult to evolve. We at least have a responsibility not to destroy ourselves anytime soon. Perhaps we would have a responsibility to, terraform the planet, something like that, to nurture life forms we find elsewhere. In the second book, it's crowded. The universe is full of mind, but it's a dangerous place. And every so often, the core of the galaxy explodes, and it's back to the puddles again. Evolution has to restart. And so on. But in a way, that series was a response to the Zili universe. Maybe the Zili universe doesn't really fit with what we observe. So what kind of universes do? So.
Alors, je ne sais pas si vous le savez, mais la série des Zili n'a pas été traduite en français au moment de sa sortie. Elle est en cours de traduction. C'est-à-dire que nous avons actuellement, pour nous, c'est tout nouveau, les Zili en France. Et nous redécouvrons... dont vous venez de parler, donc de vos romans Archives de jeunesse, enfin les romans, disons, du début de votre carrière. Et donc, si je comprends bien, c'est une question que je voulais vous poser, cela reste d'actualité. Ces textes sont toujours d'actualité. Enfin, si vous disiez, c'est des romans de 87, donc c'est des romans qui ont un petit peu vieilli, vous les voyez toujours d'actualité.
Oh, well, yes, I think so. The science, the first novel was called Raft in English and Gravité in French, which I think is a better title, actually. And it's about an alternate universe in which gravity, the force of gravity, is much, much stronger, a billion times stronger. And you have a crew of humans trapped in this exotic universe, struggling to survive. So I think what's dated about the Zili universe is just... From my point of view, it's my understanding of the Fermi paradox. And I did try to explore that in the Destiny's Children books. There are sections set in the near future, or even the present day, I think, in which the Zili events are affecting life on Earth now. But the early books, I think they stand up as SF, if you see what I mean. The science hasn't dated particularly. So the science ideas haven't dated. Partly because I went as far as I could with those books. I've never seen any point in, if you're writing hard SF, there's a good discipline. You take some idea, then you follow the consequences. If this happens, and this happens, and then this happens, go as far as you can. The second book, which I think has just been published, Time Like Infinity, I don't know the French title.
Je n'ai pas là.
No. Is a more philosophical book in a way. And the idea with that book is, it's another bit of unresolved science, in a sense. With quantum mechanics, this mystery of the observer and the observed, nothing is real until we observe it. The glass here isn't real until I look at it. Many possibilities which collapse to one when I observe it. But who observes me? Maybe I'm not real until you observe me. You aren't real until the audience observes you. And so you can imagine a chain of observers. Nothing is real until the final observation is made. So there is one theory pushing that as far as you can go, that nothing is real in the universe about our history until the final observer at the end of time, the ultimate observer, makes the final observation, and then everything becomes real. All the alternate histories collapse down into one. And in the book, Earth is occupied, and a bunch of humans try to send a message to this guy saying, we don't like this history, give us another one. So I think it's a fantastic idea, but it is a logical consequence of quantum mechanics. So that's still topical, I think. Some of these books, I do get quite a lot of fan mail, especially now with websites. You know, it's easier for people to write, and the ideas in those early books, such as that one, really intrigue people. You know, because they're dramatized. It's a really big idea, big cosmic idea about the nature of reality, but it's dramatized as people try to manipulate it in the stories. So I think those things just stay topical. Yes.
Oui, alors effectivement, vous disiez que vous faites de l'art science et aussi un petit peu de, enfin, beaucoup de philosophie. J'entendais dire récemment, par quelqu'un de science-fiction, que l'art science était passé de mode, que le 21e siècle était tourné vers l'imaginaire et vers le spirituel. Donc ce qui tombe très bien dans ce que vous dites. C'est ce que disent certains, mais vous écrivez l'art science avec déjà de la philosophie derrière. Alors pensez-vous vraiment que l'art science est quelque chose qui est fini, actuellement ?
Nope. I think it's alive and kicking. Another version of the same question is science fiction itself defunct? Because so much has happened that was in the science fiction pages of the past. You know, we've been to the moon and we stopped. So, well, you know, has science fiction run out of material? But no, I mean, to me, science fiction is a kind of response to change. You know, going back to H.G. Wells again, his early books were all about evolution, or rather a response to evolution. He was the first generation to be taught evolution in the classroom. The previous generation was Darwin's generation. His generation in the 1890s, the 1880s, the first to be taught the reality of evolution in the classroom. And so society was still trying to come to terms with this astonishing idea. First of all, the great spans of time, unlike the comforting, you know, few thousand years of the Bible. And secondly, the godlessness of it, the idea that we could have been shaped by a universe like a machine. What an extraordinary thing to have to grasp. And so Wells's early books were all about this, I think. The time machine, you see the results of evolution. Dr. Moreau, the island of Dr. Moreau is a parable of evolution. The Martians in the War of the Worlds are like advanced humans in a way, huge brains, you know, come to invade the more primitive relatives, perhaps, and so on. So Wells's books were like therapy, in a way, it's like a psychologist telling you stories to help you understand the trauma. Well, it seems to be in this coming century, 100 years after Wells, that we've got plenty of change, haven't we? If we do nothing, you know, we've got the resource depletion, the oil is running out. We have climate change, which one way or the other looks like it's going to impact us all. Dramatic changes coming down the pipe. So if ever we needed a literature that explores these possibilities, it's now, I think. So the science fiction we're writing now may not much resemble the science fiction that was being written in 1940 or 1950, but the need for it as a way to spark the imagination of the readers on the one hand, and the way for writers and readers to work through these issues on the other hand is still very valid, I think. My most recent books have been Flood and Ark, and that's a two-book sequence about a global flood, essentially, like Noah's flood, but happening in the present day. So in the first book, the world floods, and in the second book is about building an ark, a spacecraft, to try and save at least some of humanity. And they're one of my responses to climate change, in which the very basis of the world in which we live is changing so dramatically. The parables, the world isn't going to flood in that quite as dramatically as that, but the parables of how it feels to live in such a world and how we cope with it and how we think about it. In a way, I was inspired to write those books by Christopher Priest, and he's popular in France, I think, isn't he? Christopher Priest, you know him? And he wrote a review of a book, a non-fiction book about climate change. And Chris Priest has written great science fiction, but he said he was blocked by the idea of climate change. It seemed to him to make science fiction meaningless. He couldn't write anymore. And I thought, well, maybe I should be writing. Am I blocked about climate change? So I tried to write about climate change in Flood and Ark, also in one of the Destiny's Children's books. They do a big geoengineering project in which they try to stabilize the ice caps at the North Pole. One of these big adventurous schemes to try to fix the world. how could you get the political momentum to make it work? What are the morals of doing this? Could we be sure that we're not going to make things worse by trying this and so forth? So it seems to me that science fiction is a way of exploring all these issues. I spoke to Chris Priest about this later. I said, you know, Chris, I was inspired to write these books partly by your comment about being blocked, and he couldn't remember saying it. So there you go. But I think he did.
Bien, je vous remercie beaucoup de répondre à toutes mes questions. Ce que je vous propose, c'est de demander aux gens qui sont dans la salle s'il y a des gens qui ont envie de poser des questions. Vous avez Stéphane Baxter devant vous. Donc, si vous avez des questions à poser, profitez-en.
Oui, bonjour. Alors, je voudrais vous demander, vous explorez l'univers des Illy depuis vos tout premiers textes. Ça fait maintenant quelque chose comme, je crois, 7 romans et pas loin d'une cinquantaine de nouvelles dans le même univers. Et pourtant, vous continuez encore d'écrire toujours dans cet univers. Et ce que je voudrais savoir, est-ce qu'il n'y a pas une difficulté particulière à continuer à rajouter des nouvelles pierres à cet édifice ?
Yes, it. After my first set of novels and stories, up to about 1995, I think. So by then, I'd been working on these stories for 7 or 8 years. Yes, I thought I'd run out of things to say in that universe. You're right. It's like a building where the gaps get filled in, like a jigsaw puzzle, where the remaining pieces fit a bit too easily. And I took a step back from it. What inspired me to go back to the Zili world in the first place, actually, was I visited Japan, and the Japanese. I've written a range of SFs. I've written alternate history, near future stuff, far future stuff, and the Zili big scale space operatic stuff. The Japanese really seem to like the far future space operatic stuff, so they like the Zili books. So they were asking me questions about the Zili books. And that inspired me. So this is 3 or 4 years later. That inspired me to go back, and eventually that inspiration became the Destiny's Children books. But by that time, now the first of those I worked on in something like 2002, I think, which is about 7 years after I'd worked on the previous set of novels. And I do have an odd theory that about how the mind works, at least my mind. As a writer, if I look back to books 3 or 4 years old, for some reason I may have to proofread an edition in America, something like that, or maybe I'm going to do a new story based on the world of the book. If it's 3, 4, 5 years old, it still seems very familiar. You know, obviously I remember writing it, but it still seems internal to me. If it's more than 6, 7, 8 years old, I still remember writing it. I remember putting it all together, but it's as if somebody else wrote it. So there seems to be like a 7-year cycle or a 7-year horizon in the mind. Beyond that, it's like somebody else's work in a way. So now, going back to my earliest books, I've just produced a sequel to Raft, to Gravité. This is purely a vanity thing. In 2011, that book will be 20 years old. So I thought, well, I'll do a sequel as a novella, just to show off, really. I'm still here after 20 years. So I had to read Raft again, my first novel. And it is, as I said, I remember every detail in a way of working on it, but it is like somebody else's work. So it's more like collaborating with somebody else. Or it's actually more like, you know, I did a sequel to H.G. Wells' The Time Machine, so I had to study the work of another writer in that context. So there's a bit more of a flavor of collaborating with somebody else. So that's one answer. But another is simply, as I said, you know, I've become interested in different things over the years. The early books, I think, were very ideas-driven. I mean, you have to have compelling characters and character stories to make any work of fiction work. But I have become more interested in the characters in later years. How does it feel to be a child soldier in the middle of a million-year war, and so on, which immediately gives you new stories to tell. In Destiny's Children, I became fascinated by the idea great events in past history shape us today. So the wars of the 20th century or the rise and fall of Rome, great events in the past have echoes in the present. And I wondered if in the future, with time travel and all the rest, maybe the great events of the future will have echoes in the present. So the first of those books, Coalescence, I think it's Coalescence in the French edition, is set in the present day, but more or less the present day. But it's a present which in which echoes of the galactic war a million years ahead are filtering back in time, echoes of the future. So you know it's different ways into the same stories and the same material. I do try to keep to be consistent, you know, to keep track of the dates and so forth. And what I usually do is I'll draft the story or draft the book and then try and check all the other stuff. Usually it's just a question of changing small things to make it consistent. I'd rather be consistent than to have the thing littered with errors of you know, which irritates readers, I think, who do track these things. But again, with Destiny's Children, again, after three books and a bunch of short stories, again, the window seemed to close a little bit. You know, it's... again, I've run out of things to say in a way, but I'm sure I'll come back to it in the future.
D'autres questions?
Bonjour.
Hello.
D'abord, merci infiniment pour vos livres. La question était, est-ce qu'il y a des auteurs particuliers qui l'ont incité, est-ce qui vous ont incité à vous tourner vers la hard science, ou est-ce que c'est un goût personnel pour la documentation technique de la NASA, par exemple?
Well, actually, I think it's a mixture of personal taste and who I found. I had a Catholic education. In a Catholic school, a strict Catholic school, my secondary school, run by an order of Irish monks. You know, we had secular teachers as well, but I had a very strict Catholic education, two masses a week until I was 18. I think I grew out of it. It never seemed to take with me. But although I did sing in the choir, but I did grow up with this sense of the universe having a story. It might not be the Christian story, but the universe ought to have a story. So when I was 11, 12, I kind of graduated through Star Trek, you know, to people like A. Van Vogt, to Clark, especially Clark and Stapledon. In my school library, I was very lucky. My school had had been given a gift of science fiction book club novels from the 50s and the 60s. So I think pretty much all the classics you can think of from that kind of era were there. Asimov, Clark, Bradbury, all these people were just there on the shelves at the school library. And I got thrown out of the library because I was reading them too quickly. I'd take one out, read it, and take it back the next day to get another one. They thought I was... I don't know what they thought I was doing, but, you know, I was banned from the library for a while. And many years later, I went back to open a new library at the school with a plaque with my name on, and I told that story. It was like revenge. However, I shouldn't complain because it was a good library and it had excellent science fiction. But it was especially Clark and a little bit later Stapledon, because Stapledon is that much harder to read. The big scale, you know, the very far future in which man is either extinct or transformed. You get all this stuff in Clark. So in a way, you see, it was the mystical stuff that attracted me to that breed of science fiction, because you have to have a certain sense of the mystical, of the numinous, I think, to be able to write that stuff. I mean, Clark is another contradiction, isn't he? I think Clark, I worked with Clark and I knew him quite well. He thought he was an engineer, I think. In fact, he was more like a mystic in his head. He'd never have said that, I don't think. He did say he was attracted to the mysterious as opposed to the mystical. But I think he was attracted to that whole area of philosophy, the meaning of life, you know. And that's why there's this great quality of the numinous in his writing. So I think, you know, so in a way, the NASA technical documents, I loved all that as well, but that's like the first rungs on the ladder, you know. It was Clark and Stapledon who showed me the vision of the top of the ladder.
Y a-t-il d'autres questions? Une personne qui...
Bonjour. Alors, je voudrais poser une autre question. Il y a depuis quelque temps à Hollywood un projet d'adaptation de Fondation, l'archi-classique d'Asimov. Et bon, personnellement, ça me fait un peu peur. Hein. Ce que je voudrais savoir, c'est ce que vous, ça vous tenterait de voir un jour l'un de vos travaux adaptés, que ce soit au grand écran ou à la télévision?
Oh, yeah, I would love to see it, yes. And I've come close a few times. My novel Moonseed was optioned for a movie to be made in Europe, but the movie company went bust, as happens. And there was some interest in Voyage. It could have been a kind of sequel to Apollo 13, you know, Apollo 13, using the same kind of special effects technology at the time, but that came to nothing. And more recently, my Time Odyssey series with Clark, Time's Eye, was optioned by Hallmark in America. That would have been a miniseries. And they got as far as plans to build... that's a book about time slices. And so Babylon was featured, half of it as it was at the time of Nebuchadnezzar, the other half ruined as in the present day. They were going to build a mock-up of this thing in the Indian desert. It was going to be a big production, but again it fell through. So I've been close a few times, and maybe one day. As I said, my novel Voyage was dramatized by the BBC on audio. I have to say, I wouldn't be too proud about it. I mean, it seems to me that what you want is to get your work filmed and for it to be successful and not to be too precious about what they do with the characters and all these things. Because then the second project, you have more power, your name has more power. So they can do what they like with the first one, and then maybe I'd have more influence on the second. But I do think the movies, there are some very smart and relatively low-budget movies around now, aren't there? Such as Time Crimes, I watched recently. If you know that, it's a Spanish-language movie. Quite low-budget, a sort of time paradox movie. So I think it's quite possible to do very intelligent work, you know, on a reasonable budget now. There was actually an independent producer who was interested in the Destiny's Children series. Now, there, one book is set in... Well, two books are set more or less in the present day, but the middle book, it's Galactic War. And I said to him, well, I presume you're talking about the present-day ones. No, he said, the Galactic War. You want to do the Galactic War. Well, again, it's come to nothing, but you never know. One of these days, maybe it will happen.
Bien, merci beaucoup, Stéphane Baxter, de votre participation aujourd'hui. Je crois que nous vous retrouverons encore demain et après-demain sur des conférences. Et merci à tout le monde et aux traducteurs en particulier qui font un bon travail. Merci beaucoup.
Yes, thank you, translation. Thank you for your questions. Okay.